automobiles has local accelerometers, well calibrated, which know exactly when you've speeded up and slowed down, whether you've made a turn and so on, because you're using Waze or something like that. It knows instantaneously what is your exact speed and direction. So I'm convinced that GPS is being augmented by accelerometers in the modern day GPS function in automobiles. W2CDL, K2IW.
Okay, W8CDL, yes. Yeah, definitely. You know, given what my car does, and okay, heck, I didn't know that you also had Subarus in the Outback, which is what I just got. If you didn't hear, I bought a 2019 Outback, and I got it in August. So I'm still learning it. I took my long trip down to Shelby, North Carolina, and that's a 700-mile trip in one direction. So I already put 1,500 on, and then of course local driving. So, and I'm going up to New Hampshire at the end of this week, so I'll be putting on more mileage. The thing that I'm still learning to see all the features that the car does and has and how it works. What I found so far, which I didn't like, is using the GPS on Google Maps. They're not using Google Maps. They're using TomTom, which I guess is another, just another function of displaying voice activation as far as location and where to go. But what it kept on doing was giving me erroneous readings for some reason, and I don't know how to reset it. I have to, unless you do. I got to look at the book and see if the GPS is giving me the not the wrong directions. It kept telling me to exit at a certain exit over and over and over again, even when I passed the exit. And for some reason, I wasn't even going to that location in the first place. So I don't know why it did what it did until it finally corrected itself, but it took a long time. So I don't know why. When I take a long trip, then I program onto the map of my destination, I'll see how it works again. But because I haven't used it for local driving, because I don't need it, cause it's all local. But I'll try it and see if there was an issue with that or what. But as far as resetting, maybe Hank, you know how to reset it, because I couldn't find any information on how to reset if something hangs up. Other than pulling over, turning off the ignition, turning the key off, letting things shut down, and then restarting everything, which I don't want to do. I don't want to pull over for that. So maybe there was another function on...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
All right, sorry for the timeout, talking too long. Anyway, Hank, that's the situation that I came across. With that, so I'll give it back to you.
Bazuru, comment?
Okay, I heard somebody comment you can address the net controller in one way, anyway.
Yeah, Hank first and then Bravo Zulu right after that. Go ahead, Hank.
Yeah, Andy, what you need to do is you need to go to route and destinations. I'm sorry, first, destinations. And then cancel route. And what's happened is when the route was being compiled, for some reason, and that you might have the initial XM period of radio that they give you when you buy the car. I think they give you 6 months. And that will put what it calls traffic routing in. And oftentimes the traffic routing is not what you want to do. It'll take you off of a highway and have you go some back road for 5 miles or so and then back on the highway. And it takes a long time for it to realize that you're not going to do that and correct. So if you get one of those problems, the easiest way to do it is simply to cancel your route and then start your route again. And it'll do that, I want to say, in flight. By that I mean when the car is moving and the GPS is, knows that it's moving, but it's a destination you've already entered, so it has it in memory, as opposed to if you're trying to put a destination in while you're driving, which it won't allow you to do because you're moving.
Oh, okay, so I cancel the route and then just... because it's in memory, that makes sense. And I bring it back up, and it'll fix that. Okay. Yeah, I'll have to play with that. You know, again, because I'm doing a lot of local driving, I'm not using it at all. It's only for long distance driving when I put my destination in, so I'll have to play with that and get used to it. Another learning curve. So as I mentioned, I have a 2019. The Outback also, which is it's a great ride. I love the car. It's really good, and it was rated, as you know. With that, let me give it back to Dick, because there was Mother Rich is on W2BZ. Go ahead, Dick.
One final comment.
Go ahead, Hank.
As you guys know, I used to operate aircraft that had GPSs. And I have to tell you that this Subaru GPS system, which was manufactured by the Fujitsu 10 Corporation in Japan, is one of the least intuitive GPS mapping systems and navigation systems that I have ever used. That's it.
What do you mean by least intuitive? Are you saying it's not being rapidly updated by accelerometers? Hank, go ahead.
Negative. I think it's updated very quickly, but I just think the lawyers got involved with setting up the parameters of how you program your destinations and what input it looks at. For example, my sister owns a different vehicle, made in Japan also, and she has a button on her GPS that says, are you the driver? And if there's a passenger input and there's weight in the passenger seat, it will allow a passenger to program the GPS while the vehicle's moving. And the Subarus don't do that. If the vehicle's moving, it simply will not allow you to change many things in the way the GPS is programmed. It's also very difficult to do the initial programming. It wants you to start first with the state in the U.S., zip code if you have it, which I usually don't have for my destinations, and then it wants the city, and then it wants the street number, and then it wants the street number in that sequence. Whereas most GPSs, you can just write in a single line of where you want to go, and the software will figure out if that's close, and you say yes or no to that. It's simply a problem with how the lawyers got involved with writing the software.
Can I make a comment on it?
Go ahead.
Okay. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I don't like this particular map function and the way it works, and that's one thing I noticed. They're using TomTom as their navigation, the site app that they use. But I was wondering if I could change that to a different app. I'm just using the word app because I don't know what to label it. You know, like I use Google Maps on my iPhone, for instance, and I found that I had that turned on. I was using Google Maps as well as the GPS in the car, and they were not giving me the same results. The car was telling me to go in this, to take these certain streets, while Google Maps told me to take other streets to get to the same spot, the same destination. I like Google Maps better than what the car is telling me. Is there any way that the firmware or this application can be changed so it's better? This is another question I have. Go ahead, Hank.
Yeah, the short answer is no, but the long answer is if you join the Subaru Outback forums and create a username in your profile, and then you can access the joint wisdom of a lot of Subaru owners. I grant you that most of the stuff is relative to snow tires and oil changes and things like that, but there are guys that are technical that get into how the audio and infotainment system works, which is what they call the GPS and all the telephone all bundled together. But the short answer is, yeah, I'm unaware of it. Subaru themselves changed the provider of their information systems for the 2020 model year. It's a, you know, it's a new generation this model year, and that's provided by the Bose Corporation, and it's it allows you to use Waze and Google Maps and all the rest of that. But unfortunately, we're kind of stuck with what they had before this.
Oh, so it's not you can't upgrade the firmware. Yeah. Of course, you know, I thought about that, Hank. Believe it or not, before I bought this car, I was debating whether to buy the 2020 or buy a 2019, but the 2019 was a lot, you know, was cheaper, especially the fact that they're trying to get, you know, dealers are getting rid of the 2019s and making room for the 2020s. But I also said, and of course I knew this, that, you know, the newer firmware would be out and probably has more features and it's easier to use and so on. And that's going to be the trend, you know, each year. You know, in 5 years from now, the features of my car will probably be obsolete. And as I said earlier, the car will probably be completely driving itself if I bought a new car then. I'm sure by 10 years from now, because as you know, they're already playing around with these experimental cars that drive itself. All right, anyway, enough on that. Rich W2BZ is out there, so, well, Dick, let me give it to you, and I'm going to sign out because it's quarter after nine. I got to take care of a couple of things for work tomorrow. So it's been fun, and I haven't spoken this long on the TechNet in a long time. Dick, back, and thanks, Hank, for your input, too, and everybody else. Dick, back to you, WHCDL. 8 seconds.
Late chicken, we'll get you in a second. Andy, thank you for checking in. We haven't heard you from a long time. We're about to turn it over to Bravo Zulu. And we've also got, when it comes to check-ins, we got Dave that we've been holding off for an awful long time. Alpha Alpha Mike. New check-in, tell us your call letter and name, sir. K2RIW.
KD2RMD Russell and Quam.
Was it Kilo Bravo 2? Romeo, Mike, David, is that what it was?
Kilo Delta 2, Romeo, Mike, Delta.
Okay, we got you, Russell. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu. Go ahead, Rich.
Comment on why they probably don't, or why they don't allow you to access book for a phone number. And it's exactly that. They don't want people searching through 20, 30, 40, 50 names while they're driving. So that sounds logical to me anyway, as why they don't allow that. And Dick, after you handle the other questions before me, I get to ask you a couple of questions about a patch antenna.
Okay, we'll put you on the list. We've been keeping Dave into Alpha Alpha Mike waiting for an awful long time. If you're still with us, Dave, go right ahead. November 2, Alpha Alpha Mike, K2RIW.
Okay, K2RIW in the net. This is at 2 a.m. Dave in Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey. Question for you. Total change of subject to receivers and that technology. I understand that how basic sensitivity and selectivity works in a receiver. The lower amount of microvolts at the input of the receiver indicates how weak of a signal the receiver can receive. But one thing I don't understand, or how it relates to microvolts, is the ratings that I see on a lot of equipment. I don't see the microvolt sensitivity anymore. I see minus 100 dBm, minus 110 dBm, minus 80 dBm. What does that actually mean, Dick?
Okay. dBm stands for decibels with reference to 1 milliwatt. So 1 milliwatt is 0 dBm. One microvolt is minus 107 dBm, so it's an easy conversion for that, at least at one point. One microvolt, minus 107 dBm. Two microvolts would be 6 dB above that, or below that, two microvolts would be, let me think now, minus 107 plus 6 is minus 101 dBm. So it's decibels with reference to 1 milliwatt. It's a system of units that's very often used with microwave signals. It was also used a lot with the Bell system for measuring audio levels. dBs, dBm. There's dBV, with dB with reference to volt. dBmV, dB with reference to a millivolt or a microvolt. So dBm is with reference to 1 milliwatt. Does that make some sense? Back to you, sir. K2RIW. Was that W2 Bravo Zulu that asked that question? Or was that Dave? Yeah, I think it was Dave. Into Alpha Alpha Mike. Go ahead, Dave.
Bravo Zulu.
That's it. Now I'm not sure who asked the question about microvolt, or dBm. Or who asked the question about dBm? Was that you, Rich?
What's Dave?
Okay, let's see if Dave got his question answered. And I think he said he's got either he or someone else had said he got a question about patch antennas. November 2, Alpha Alpha Mike, K2LIW. Go ahead, Dave.
I give him a little time. He's on echoing. Give him some space to come in.
Okay, we're going to give Dave some space. Go right ahead, Dave.
Okay, with the latency, like I couldn't get in, with so many people keying up. But as far as the, receiver is more sensitive as the dBm rate goes down. In other words, the receiver that's minus 110 dBm is not as sensitive as the receiver that's minus 117 dBm. And I understand dB from audio work. I know about that regarding the Bell system. I just wasn't sure exactly what that acronym stood for. Just couldn't relate it to microvolts. Now I can. So that essentially is it. Okay, it was a simple but easily answerable question, Dick. Thank you very much. K2RIW in the net. This is N2AAM clear. Go back to listening.
Very fine, Dave. Now, you could be a little bit confused by, is a receiver that's rated for sensitivity of minus 117 dBm better than one that's rated for minus 110 dBm? In pure sensitivity connected to laboratory test equipment, the answer is yes. When that receiver is connected to an antenna that's looking at the real world, something very different takes place. Every one of us maybe have at one time or another run the experiment of where you take a clip lead that's a couple of feet long, connect it to the center conductor of the UHF connector on the back of the receiver, and listen to, say, 80 meters. And you hear all those beautiful signals with a great signal-to-noise ratio, but the S-meter does not move very much. From that, you can say that a receiver is very forgiving. That piece of random length of wire, only a couple of feet long, connected to the back of the receiver, probably has a standing wave ratio of 1,000 to 1. It's an extremely poor match to the receiver. Yet the receiver gives you a good signal-to-noise ratio. How in the world can that be? You'll notice that when you connect a real 80-meter dipole, you'll get a signal will be an S9 on the receiver, and the noise will be S3. You connect that little random length of clip lead, and that same signal you're listening to is S2, and the noise in the background is S0. Because the amount of noise being picked up by an antenna looking at the horizon is maybe 40 dB above KTB, so to speak. It's 40 dB above some particular common reference. The noise is so high that when you have an extremely poor antenna on the receiver, it may be getting only 1% of the normal signal strength, but it's getting 1% of the noise, it's getting 1% of the signal, and the ratio of signal to noise stays the same. Your automatic gain control, let me drop. The receiver's automatic gain control takes over. The receiver cranks its gain up real high. And so, with a really lousy antenna, you can still hear signals with normal signal-to-noise ratio because the dominant amount of signal is the noise of the horizon on, say, 80 and 40 meters. You do that on 2 meters, where the noise in the background is so much quieter, you can't tolerate cutting back the signal that much with a poor antenna, and you get poor sensitivity. So HF has a peculiar characteristic. So even though the receiver with only minus 108 dBm sensitivity is a lot less sensitive, that may be more than enough sensitivity for when that antenna is connected, when the receiver is connected to a real antenna that's looking at the noise on 80 meters. Does that make a little bit of sense? Over to you, Dave. N2AAM, we'll wait for you to come back. K2RIW to TechNet.
K2RIW in the net, this is M2AAM. Yes, it does make sense. In fact, it brings to mind a video which I saw on YouTube a while back. A gentleman up in Massachusetts was demonstrating a beverage antenna, and he was listening to some signals from Europe at about 4 o'clock Eastern time in the winter, and it was almost even with the noise, and on a standard 80-meter dipole or a vertical or whatever, and we switched to the beverage, the noise level dropped down, but the signals went up. So I certainly see where that comes from at 80 meters, and I understand the primary thing about low bands, particularly 40, 80, and maybe to an extent 20, it is more dependent on the noise level on the band than the noise figure of the receiver. That ultimately helps in theory. I think that kind of bangs into what you said, over.
Yes, it does. The noise in the background makes a huge difference, whether or not the band is open or not open. Sometimes you can tell that by the amount of noise you're seeing. The beverage antenna, if it's aimed in the right direction, could, in theory, if he's made it long enough, have a whole lot of gain in the direction of Europe he's listening to. And that can drastically, because of the gain in that direction, the directivity could drastically increase the signal that he's listening to from Europe. So the beverage is capable of being lower in noise, higher in gain, more directive toward the desired target, which may be with Europe. So that partially explains why the signal sounds so much better on the beverage. If you've got enough real estate, beverage antenna can give you a lot of gain if you make it long enough and properly installed. And the beverage antenna usually has a 600 ohm or something like that terminating resistor at the far end. And if you decide to, with relays, flip the terminating resistor to the near end and feed the far end, you can make the beverage antenna work in the opposite direction, 180 degrees apart. And so you may aim it to the northeast to get to Europe, and to the southwest to get to maybe Australia, I'm not sure. So beverage is a beautiful antenna, but it takes a lot of real estate to build a really good one. You would like the wire of the beverage to be multiple wavelengths long, very similar to a rhombic antenna. You'd like each of those legs to be multiple wavelengths long. Any other final comments, Dave, before we go over to the next person? N2AAM, we'll wait for you to come back. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. That about covers it. So another question answered, another satisfied customer here. So back to you for the rest of the net. Thanks a lot. K2RIW, this is N2AAM clear.
Okay, the last person who signed in was Kilo Delta 2, Romeo Mike Delta, I think it is. Russell. Go ahead, Russell. K2RIW in the TechNet. KD2RMD, K2RIW. Russ, your signal was very weak. We only heard you for 5% of the time on the previous transmission, And at the end, you asked, are you getting through? You're getting through right now, so try repeating your question. And if you have any more power you could give us, it would be helpful. Over to you, Russ, in New Jersey.
Apologize for that. I had to switch to my AC station. Now to my base station. So my question is, I have a triple point in the dipole. And I moved it from my attic to the bedroom. I live in an HOA. I have a lot of restrictions. And my question is how critical or important is it to have, say, a one-to-one balance on the antenna? I use a 20-foot long coaxial cable, and I had severe RF problems when the antenna was in the attic. When it was in the attic, I was using 50-foot long RG8X cable, and the noise was horrific. I was transmitting noise, my antenna tuner began to malfunction, so I moved it and it seems to be working, but I'm just wondering, if I use the one-to-one balance, would that help with the RF coming back into the shack?
The answer is definitely yes, Russ. If you connect a dipole directly with the coax cable, shield going to the left hand, the center conductor going to the right half of the dipole itself is a balanced antenna. It wants to be fed on the first half cycle plus voltage on the right side and minus voltage on the left side, and the second half cycle opposite. The dipole, therefore, when it's being used as a load on coax directly connected to it, the shield of the dipole becomes hot. The dipole just feeds energy back that way without a balance. Therefore, what you think is the dipole doing the radiating is the dipole plus the shield, the outer conductor of the coax cable. And that coax cable wends its way through your house and is radiating that signal, coming near appliances and giving lots of RF in the shack, in the house. The proper kind of a balance applied right at the feed point of the dipole stops that from happening. You could do a poor man's balance. Let me drop. You can install a commercially made balance, maybe one-to-one at that point. That's one approach. A poor man's balance is a number of turns of coax cable right at the antenna acting as an RF choke. And how much RF choke do you need? You can calculate that ahead of time. You'd like the choking action at your operating frequency to be high compared to 50 ohms. In other words, by knowing the number of turns and the diameter of your turns, by way of the formula that's in the radio amateur's handbook, you can calculate the number of microhenries of those turns of coax at your operating frequency. And then inductive reactance is 2 pi FL. L is the inductance, F is frequency in hertz, and 2 pi. So you calculate on 80 meters how many microhenries of RF choke you need. That tells you how many turns it's got to be in order to be high enough inductance so that the RF energy is now choked off. It's like on a 50 ohm coax, you'd like 500 ohms of inductive reactance on that poor man's balance. So you can do it by a poor man's balance or instructing a real balun there. But the balun now forces a balance condition. It isolates the shield of the coax from the dipole, and therefore the coax stops radiating, and in many cases that will improve electromagnetic interference. So the dipole itself doesn't stop working because you're not using a balun, but the resonant frequency becomes a lot more controlled. You're not using the coax itself as part of the antenna once the balun is there. KD2RMD, K2RAW, go ahead, Russ.
The four-man balun that I would use, and I would have to pretty much disassemble this via the dipole and start from scratch, or just buy another version of the same dipole that comes with the balun. Would it make a difference if I did the poor man's balance, because the antenna and the coaxial cable is in my apartment. So balance or no balance, the cable is still in the shed. Okay, so I know the balance will prevent RF from going to the radio, but the whole system is in the shed. With
Dave, are you using a handy-talky and walking around because your signal keeps coming and going? From Quorum, I don't think it should be doing that. Over to you, Dave.
Hey, about that, I had to switch to my HC once my two-year-old goes to bed. That pretty much shuts down my base station. But, no, I'm seated down outside in a good spot right now. And I might be up in the backyard, so it should be solved. Back to you.
You're giving the repeater a very weak signal. The poor man's balun mounted right at the antenna. It's an easy thing to add. By disconnecting the coax, putting a connector there, you could add an extra length of coax right at that point with the turns of the poor man's balun. And don't worry about the insertion loss of connectors and adapters. That's a highly misunderstood area. They don't have insertion loss properly installed. So, you've got the choice of adding a poor man's balun, a real balun. I think you're saying the whole antenna is in the shack with you. So whenever your antenna is inside the house, where it's close to the appliances of the house, by the inverse square law, you're doing your radiating from the antenna, which is what it wants to do, but by being very close to the appliances, you're going to get some grief. The antenna, if you can install it outdoors, with a greater distance between the antenna and the appliances, would make this problem a hell of a lot better, particularly with the balun installed. So, what if that all makes some sense, Russ? KD2RMD, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, KD2RMD IDing. Thank you much for the insight. It would be pretty simple for me to just roll up a couple of turns on the coaxial cable and then tie it off. And, add or take away the turns from there to see if that helps. As of right now, I don't have any interference. When the dipole was in the attic, my antenna tuner wasn't working. I was setting off a fire alarm. I was transmitting a horrific hum. it was bad. As of right now, that's not happening. But that's not to say that it could happen again. So I'll give it a try. And if anything, if it brings down my my noise floor, that'll KD2RMD, I thank you very much for helping out. I was looking forward all week to getting some insight on it. So, thank you on 73, so that's all. Back to the control.
Very fine, Russ. As you add that balun and see the difference in performance, come back and let us know how that works out. Now, who was it that had a question on a patch antenna? Was that Bravo Zulu? The patch antenna question person, go ahead, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, it was Bravo Zulu, sir.
Okay, go ahead, Rich, with your question. And you're a little bit noisy, so be careful.
Okay, I'm getting very interested in downloading and decoding satellite signal. And for that, I want to construct a patch antenna, and there are many, as you can imagine, calculators out there to give you the dimensions of the patch antenna. But I've never worked in the gigahertz range, and I'm just wondering, if let's say one satellite's at 1.55 gigahertz and another one's at 1.1 gigahertz, is that patch antenna that's designed for the 1.55 would that work not well at all? And I'm just talking about receiving. Not well at all at 1.1 gig? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a pretty valid question there, Rich. Patch antennas work very well when properly designed. They tend to be rather narrow band. The bandwidth of the patch antenna is primarily a function of the thickness of the substrate. If you used a 32nd of an inch printed circuit board, you'll end up with a very narrow band antenna. If you use quarter inch thick microstrip board, you'll end up with a much more bandwidth. And you could, you don't have to have the patch antenna directly on printed circuit board. You could put an air spacing between the patch and the ground plane. As you increase that spacing, the patch becomes more and more broadband. So those two frequencies you mentioned, you tune for one, and you could have an extremely high standing wave ratio on the other frequency with a typical patch design. But as I said, There are various ways you can increase the bandwidth of a patch, and the main function is the thickness between the radiator and its ground plane. That distance really determines the bandwidth. If you go to the radio, if you go to the antenna engineering handbook, the more modern version, and you can, there's versions of that you can get. Let me drop. There are versions of the antenna engineering handbook you can get online, and you go to the chapter on patch antennas. They will make this more clear. So you're going to have to be careful to try to get that kind of bandwidth. Other than that, there are ways where you could change the patch itself. Design the patch for the higher frequency. Have a way of adding a stray capacitance to the radiator section of the patch, which tunes it to the lower frequency. You add a piece of copper tape to the right position on the patch antenna, you can tune it to the lower frequency. So there are ways you can make the patch switchable in frequency between those two frequencies. Over to you, Rich, W2 Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
UBC on the net. I know it's also, you could change the bandwidth by where on the radiator you would patch the coax, in the corner, in the center, whatever. I know that changes it too, but the dielectric between the radiator and the ground plane, if you put spacers between those two, then is the air between them the dielectric, and that's you can try to maximize that. I guess there's a point beyond which you have too much between the radiator and the ground plane. Is that correct, Nick?
To choose the place where you feed the patch, that is an impedance matching function, and you could mismatch the impedance by putting it in the wrong place, and you think you're getting greater bandwidth. And that's not really a bandwidth determinant. The spacing between the patch and the ground plane, that spacing in electrical wavelength is the primary function of bandwidth. And I think the bandwidth changes as that spacing squared, double that spacing, and I think you get to four times more bandwidth. It's some big fraction like that. So by going to the antenna engineering handbook, any of the versions that you can get to online, or if you really own the book, the problem goes away. You go to the section on patch antennas. There's about 30 chapters in that book. And the section on patch antennas will give you a lot of this information. If you made the spacing too great, that doesn't stop the patch from working. As you make the space greater and greater, the patch is slowly sliding from a patch over to a monopole or an inverted F, if you know what I mean. So it doesn't stop it from working. It just means that the antenna now has a different name and greater bandwidth. So that's probably part of what you're looking for, Rich. W2 Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
Yes, that is what I'm looking for. So if let's say, just for argument's sake, I'm first listening to a satellite at 1.5, then 1.1, and I need a lot of spacing for that antenna to still be efficient. Are we talking a half inch? Are we talking an inch between the patch and the ground plane? Or is there's no way that can be sort of eyeballed? And the other question is, in general, with patch antennas, are these things, it seems like, to be all the rage, but that's maybe just because I'm getting interested in it. You know, they say when you're looking for a new car, and you're looking for, let's say, a Jeep, all you see on the road is Jeeps, you know? So maybe that's why I think the patch antenna is very popular now. I don't know. But what would you think the spacing would be between 1.1 gig and 1.5, if you could guess at it at all? Go ahead, Dave.
That's a hard way to go. You could make a sliding object on the radiator of the patch so that when you want to go to the lower frequency, you slide this object so that now something extends beyond the high voltage ends of the patch, adding extra stray capacitance. You slide that object, the extra capacitance is there, and the antenna will now tune itself from 1.5 down to 1.1. So by adding capacitance to the high voltage end, you can easily tune the patch to a lower frequency and still get a good match. So to switch between your two frequencies by using capacitive gimmick structure. And by the way, if you're watching your signal on a vector network analyzer or a Visron meter or whatever, while holding a piece of copper tape on the end of a long wooden stick near the high voltage end of the patch, you will very quickly see the way the frequency of resonance changes as you add that stray capacitance. So you could make a patch antenna that you're able to mechanically flip it between frequency A and frequency B by adding stray capacitance. That's a much easier way to go, in my opinion, as long as you got the right instrumentation to know when you've hit pay dirt on the right amount of stray capacitance. W2 Bravo Zulu, K2LIW.
Would the copper ribbon be attached to the ground plane and to the radiator?
You said copper ribbon, I don't know what that means. You've got a piece of copper tape. You put it on the high voltage, you got a 1-inch square of copper tape, and you tape it down to the radiator of the patch antenna, the high voltage end, the open circuit end, where the copper tape now overlaps, it extends beyond the usual range of the patch antenna. That extra stray capacitance you've added by that piece of copper tape will tune it to a lower frequency. All you've got to now find out is how much copper tape, how much extension. So you could make a mechanical structure on the patch antenna that when you slide it back so it doesn't add extra capacitance, you're on the higher frequency, and when you slide it forward so that now you've got some overhang, it's at the lower frequency. You could make the patch antenna mechanically tunable between those two frequencies. As long as you got the right kind of instrumentation, finding that solution would be a lot easier than you think. W2 Bravo Zulu, K2LIW.
It mean copper tape, Bob. But I could see sliding it across the radiator. But how then, when you find the place that you want it to stay, how then does it get attached to the radiator?
The sliding object is continuously on the radiator. The fact that it is a metallic structure sliding across the radiator, it's the amount of stray capacitance between it and the radiator makes it electronically part of the radiator. You don't have to worry about getting a 1 ohm of contact resistance, if you know what I mean. The impedance of the high voltage end of the patch antenna is so high that just the stray capacitance, in fact, you could make the slider have a piece of a sheet of Teflon underneath it so that it's now not a sliding contact. It's got a given fixed capacitance between the sliding radiator through the Teflon tape down to the radiator itself. And now you slide it between these two separate positions where you've installed stops. And now you could make it tune to the two different frequencies depending on where that slider is located. W2 Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
K2BZ and the TechNet. Okay, now, but to both the ground plane, let's say I'm doing this out of PC D-board, both of the ground plane and the radiator, both should be copper on each side facing each other. In other words, if you have one side of the PCB board that doesn't have copper, the underside that does, and then the same thing for the ground plane. Or should it be copper facing non-copper, if you know what I mean?
If you started off with double-sided printed circuit board, and the lower surface became the ground plane, and you cut away the right amount of the upper surface, that's a good way of doing it. Try to choose a copper-clad board that's a little bit on the thick side. Don't choose the super thin stuff because you'll end up with a very narrow bandwidth. The bandwidth of the patch antenna is primarily a function of the thickness of the dielectric, whether it be the material of the printed circuit board or air. That's your choice. Copper 2-way copper is what I would recommend. Depending on how you made the patch antenna, most patch antennas are grounded at one edge, open circuit at the other edge. In other words, the left-hand side might be grounded between upper and lower. The right-hand side is the open circuit portion, and a piece of the coax connector feeds a probe between the ground plane and the radiator, and you choose the right position, the so-called 50-ohm position, so to speak, and you'll get a good impedance match. Over to you. I would make copper and copper. They don't have to be dissimilar materials. Over to you, Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
And what would you say would be, considered a thick PC board? You know, an eighth inch, a quarter inch, do they make them that thick?
They do, but it's not easy to get a hold of. 16th of an inch is thin. Eighth of an inch would be great if you can get it. Quarter inch would be even better. And if you decide to build it with sheets of plastic, and you're building your own homebrew printed circuit board with a sheet of copper for the ground plane, a sheet of plexiglass as the dielectric, and another sheet of copper as the upper radiator, you could make your own homebrew printed circuit board any thickness you want, Rich. Go ahead.
Now, what would be the difference? Let's say you have a half-inch piece of plexiglass as a dielectric. What would be the difference between a half-inch dielectric of plexiglass or a half-inch of air?
Well, the plexiglass probably has a dielectric constant of 3. So, therefore, you get nice mechanical support. You get the good electrical equivalent distance with the plexiglass. So the plexiglass gives you equivalent thickness faster than air does. Over to you, Rich, because it's got a dielectric constant of 3, a quarter inch thickness of plexiglass acts like 3/4 of an inch of air. Over to you, Rich.
Would plexiglass be the ideal material for the dielectric test?
Plexiglass is a pretty good low-loss material. Some of the low-loss materials at microwave frequencies, plexiglass, Teflon, polystyrene. There are various kinds of plastic that are real low on loss tangent. You go to a good reference data of radio engineers, you can find out what the loss tangent is of the particular dielectric material you want to use. Certain kinds of rubber, for instance, might be awfully lossy. Over to you, Rich, K2RIW.
And would the plexiglass have to be cut to the same dimension as the radiator cut to the same size as the radiator or the ground plane?
Doesn't have to be. The plexiglass could be larger than the radiator if you wanted to. There's nothing magic about the exact size of the plexiglass. Go ahead.
Be smaller.
If you made it smaller than the radiator, then portion of the radiator would think it's over air instead of over plexiglass. Go ahead.
That answers it all, I think. Is there anything magical about these antennas? Or because my other choice is right, a conical, I don't know if I'm saying, or a conical monopole, or, that other type of GPS. The antennas they use
in GPS. Maybe you're talking about a helical antenna. The patch antenna is a nice high-performance antenna. Tuning it up the first time is a learning curve. With the right kind of instrumentation, finding the resonant frequency, finding the right place to put the probe, finding the right length to get it on the right frequency. If you got the right kind of instrumentation, you'll find that solution fairly fast. What's the right kind of a feed horn for your, what's the right kind of a antenna for your satellite reception? There's a zillion choices. Choose somebody's known good design. We'll save you an awful lot of time if you do some research ahead of time. Back to you, Rich.
Okay, well, that answers it all. I guess I could actually use the readouts of the SCR software, because my VNR doesn't go up that high, I could actually use the SDR software to see and adjust the antenna. That would be my last question, Dick.
Yeah, there are kinds of software that allow you to model this antenna before you build it. And with a good modeling program, you can save yourself quite a bit of labor. You're now about to ask me what's a good modeling program. High Frequency Structure Simulator, HFSS, is a very good one. It's got a big learning curve, and it's expensive to buy. There's got to be other modeling programs that will help you. And probably various people who have done this maybe will, in their article, tell you what modeling program they used. W2 Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
Called Studio something. I wrote it down on my phone, but I don't have that phone with me. That answers it all, Dick. Thank you very much. Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu.
Okay, we're way beyond the time where I should have switched over to Dr. Roy, who's back with us after the holiday. And so, looking forward to what you've got to offer us tonight, Roy. Shana Tova, a Shap Takshin. Say, I think it is. This is current year. AC2GS, K2RIW, go ahead, Ray.
Thank you very much, Dick. It's always a pleasure to be here. It's great to be back. And I listened to a recording, and you two guys did a great job last week without me. And I'm, as I said before, glad to be back. But let me just remind everyone, unless in case they possibly forgot, if you have any mailbag questions for Dick, if you can't get on the repeater on a Sunday night, you can email them to me. If you have any topics you would like me to address, questions you would like me to answer, or you don't agree with my opinion or my facts on things, please feel free to refute me. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And after I'm finished, I will post links to the stories that I discuss tonight. In addition, I've posted some pictures that Paul sent me regarding his space report from last week. So those are available at roy.ac2gs.com. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, for tonight's puzzler, I thought we might try an interesting, I hope it's interesting, a Gedanken experiment. That's a fancy German for a thought experiment. Physicists love to do things like that. Anyway, we're going to be using a magical, mystical rocket engine that doesn't exist. It contains an endless amount of a massless energy storage technology, and it's an engine that is capable of producing exactly 9.8 meters per second square of acceleration nonstop for as long as our intrepid astronaut would like to run the engine. Whatever the fictional energy source is, it's totally immaterial. It could be Zenic waves, it could be unicorn dust. It would be a really nice magical engine, though, when you consider that it would allow us to get back and forth to and from the moon in only 4 hours. It would make transcontinental supersonic trips look rather pedestrian. At that speed, we would reach any of the inner planets in a matter of days, Jupiter in a week, and Saturn in only 9 days. This is all great science fiction, but let's push this to extremes and see what we come up with. So let's suppose we found a relatively long-lived young astronaut to man this mission. He launches this mission on his 20th birthday. Now, roughly, how far do you think he might get by the time his 23rd birthday comes around?
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I think he would be into another star system, you know. Yeah, maybe Wolf 359 or something. Something in the local area. You know, we have what's called a local group that's probably 20 different stars, the nearby stars. I'd say that area.
Okay, Paul, that's very good and very accurate. For my next question, because this is a little bit on a progression plus a little story at the end, anyone hazard a guess of how far our intrepid astronaut would be by his 25th birthday?
And one whitey white.
Yes, Hank.
Well, if he gets 3 light years in the first couple of years, then he's going to do 9 light years by the time he's got a couple more years on top of that.
Okay, so roughly where would you place that then?
Oh, I'm sorry. My math's not good enough to do that.
Okay. Well, obviously farther away. But, you know, things get worse and worse in our brains. How about on his 40th birthday? Anyone hazard a guess how far would he get to the center of this galaxy? Would he get to the edge of this galaxy? Would he get anywhere near any other galaxy? Anyone with any guesses on his 40th birthday now?
That I will guess in one way anyway.
Okay.
I guess he's going to be at the end of the observable universe because he's going to have a number of years of relativistic travel as under his belt at that point.
Well, you know, I mean, you could say that it's all to a degree relativistic once he picks up any velocity. It's just the effect compounds itself over time, but you're sort of rushing to the end of this story. It's not quite that far. 20 years of accelerating at 9.8 meters per second square won't get you to the end of the universe. And we'll go into that as well, of why that won't happen.
QSAY.
SAY.
Are you assuming that this thing is going to wind up faster than the speed of light?
Well, that's the problem. You can't have something that travels faster than the speed of light. That violates the general theory of relativity.
So how long does it take before he gets up to light speed?
Takes eternity because he has a non-zero rest mass, and the amount of energy required to accelerate an object with a non-zero rest mass is an infinite amount of energy.
I'm afraid I'm not quite getting it. If he's accelerating at 9 point something meters per second, at some point he is going to hit 186,000 miles an hour. Is that the right number? I think 300 kilometers per second or something like that is the light speed. And at that point, he's just not going to be able to go any faster.
Well, you know, if you will use Newtonian physics with a slight dash of relativity, that's what you get. If you do the simple Newtonian math, by about the end of the first year, he's traveling at around 309 million miles a second, which is approximately 103% of the speed of light, which is a no-no. It's not quite as simple, unfortunately, as he gets to the speed of light and then he can't go any faster. It's unfortunately a wee bit more complicated than that, and it has to, you know, as everyone's been mentioning, it has a lot to do with relativity. And I thought this kind of Gedanken experiment would sort of make people think of relativity in a slightly different way.
Question and one way anyway.
Yes, Hank.
Isn't it an asymptotic curve? You know, he gets to some very high percentage of the speed of light, but it doesn't go any further. And it's sort of like calculus as the integral approaches x, f of x.
From our perspective, we're watching someone accelerate. He gets closer and closer and closer to the speed of light over time, but he never reaches it.
VDH with a comment?
VDH.
After 1 year, could you just say, sort of average it, say that he's at 90% of the speed of light, and use that as a rough average? I mean, it's not going to be that much of a correction. It's going